I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Matthew Leisenreiter is a producer at CBC Radio. He's one of the producers of the 180, the Sunday morning current affairs broadcast hosted by Jim Brown, which is on at 11 a.m. across the country on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius. Visit cbc.ca/the180 for clips and to listen to the whole broadcast. Matthew was the host of The Invisible Hand, a fine program on economics. Go to cbc.ca/the invisible hand for episodes. He was also a longtime producer on at On the Coast, the afternoon program on CBC Radio here in Vancouver. The Twitter handle is @_Leisen_Reiter. He's graciously appeared again to talk about current affairs, broadcasting, and perhaps we'll talk about Murphy Brown. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Matthew Leisenreiter. Mr. Leisenreiter, good morning.
Hello, Joseph. Always a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Do people ask you what your last name is?
Yes, all the time. And the secret is it's two. It's a double-barreled. It's Leisen and Reiter. Leisen is my mother. Leisen is Romanian in origin, although my mother is, the mother's side of the family is Romanian, Ukrainian, Hungarian, and Polish. And the Reiter is just good old-fashioned Bristol-based Reiter.
Or Lazy Reiter, as Shane Foxman used to call you.
Shane Foxman used to and continues to call me Lazy Reiter on his show on CKNW when he hosts and on Twitter.
Yeah.
But it's out of love.
Yeah.
It's out of love.
Yeah. And it would, so when you were in here last about a year or so ago, it was a pretty dark time at the CBC, and Shane had been let go at that point.
Mm-hmm.
With a new government and all that, is it a perhaps more rosier time at the CBC?
It's tough to say. It's difficult. So yeah, a year ago it was, and you know, I want to make the distinction between journalistically glum and like employee glum.
Sure.
Right. And so we're, as an employee of the CBC a year ago, 2 years ago, it was a bit dark because for the very specific reason that when you're part of a place that is growing and doing new things, you get happy. And when it's shrinking and doing fewer things, you get unhappy. And that would be the same were at Wendy's or McDonald's or
Esso,
right? It has nothing to do with the journalistic relationship to the government. And so now it's a little different. So there is the promise of more money, and that has allowed the CBC to try and grow in different ways. What we don't know yet is where it's going to grow. And really nobody knows where it's going to grow because nobody's quite sure about what the best role is for a public broadcaster anymore. When so much of our media is online and on demand and stuff. So it's not as gloomy to work there right now, but there's still a lot of things up in the air, and it's exciting and it's fun, and we can end up trying new things, but it's still a bit kind of pins and needles-y.
And I guess that's the media everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that, right?
Yeah.
And so do people ask you why you chose this field of endeavor?
What, specifically radio?
Or journalism, the media. I mean, I'm sure when you go up to parties and things like that, people ask you what you do, and you say you're in the media, and they're like, oh.
Yeah. Well, it's mostly because I enjoy telling stories. So many years ago, I wanted to be an actor and did a little writing and playwriting and play directing and stuff. And eventually, when looking for a longer-term career, I thought, what else can you do that you get paid to tell stories? And journalism was it. The difference is, of course, that theater is all your plot points are fictitious, and in journalism, they are based in reality. And so, but still, it gives you the same sense of good vibes and feelings inside when you tell a story right, and you tell it accurately and honestly, in a way that compels people and draws people in. It makes you feel satisfied, and it harkens back to, you know, I'm sure, sitting around campfires and telling the stories of the hunt and the very basic urges of mankind.
Yeah, and so the 180 is where you ply your trade, mm-hmm, at the moment. If you had to describe the show to people, how would you do that? It's an hour, right?
It's an hour-long show. Our goal is to find underrepresented or surprising or contrarian opinions on stuff you may have heard throughout the week. And also part of that goal is to be of Western Canada. So a lot of the CBC content that's out there comes out of downtown Toronto and Montreal and Central Canada. And, you know, there's some bits of Eastern Canada. And so the 180 was a place where we will try and find more Western Canadian perspectives. And perhaps focus on issues specific to the West that don't get as much national coverage.
And less jazz, I guess, right?
A little bit less jazz. We're not anti-jazz. Ooh, we got jazz in the West.
A lot less than, say, Enright's show.
Yes.
That's the kind of music I like, by the way.
Significantly less jazz than Sunday Edition. But we're not anti-jazz.
Yeah. The other thing too, from your years on the coast, as well as now at the 180, have a place for viewers feedback or listeners feedback, mm-hmm. I should say, and I guess is it your job, whether it was on the coast or the 180, to cull through what people said online.
Well, I'm always doing it. I mean, when I worked on the Coast, I had a kind of
because you would come on. You would come on at the top of the show with Quinn, and then you would read what people thought online.
Yeah,
and I always thought it must be just a dreadful task to have to wade through all these comments.
It was. It really was. But it was a self-imposed dreadful task. At the start of each episode of On the Coast, we would find out what was getting the most heat online in terms of CBC stories, and I would come in and read a few of the comments. We decided after a while to just end it because maybe online comments aren't often particularly deserving of high-profile exposure.
Yeah.
So I do the same with the 180. I just don't do it on the air. I'm constantly looking at what people say and what people are commenting and what they're writing in. And it's a fascinating world, and I think there's a lot to talk about in terms of the kinds of things people like to write in comment sections and the way in which people hear the material that you're making, and you think people will take it in a certain way, and in fact they take it the opposite way.
Yeah, and so is it important to feature those comments on the air, the feedback on the air? I mean, the CBC is already providing the real estate online to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I always wondered, was it necessary?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And the way we treat it at the 180, and where probably the way they do it now and on the coast, is if it's worth it, then you do it. So, I mean, the goal of comments sections and feedback is, so you present a story, and, you do your best to get a range of viewpoints and get accuracy. And so the hope is that people will listen to it or watch it or read it, and then give their opinion on an agreed set of facts, or give a personal experience that relates to it or illuminates the issue in some way, or offers their kind of specific expertise on it. And that's the goal. And I think where journalists feel less satisfied with comment sections and feedback is when people say, and to me, really, the most common theme in online comments is, this is a poor piece of journalism because it doesn't specifically reinforce my pre-existing viewpoint. And that, I think, is universal, too. Like, if you read the comments on the National Post and the Globe and Mail and the CBC and everyone, I would, this is ballpark, and, no one call me on it, but, a good portion, 50%, I don't know, is either this piece of journalism included too many views that aren't mine, or this piece of journalism neglected to include my particular opinion and viewpoint, which isn't wasn't really the point of comment sections. It was like, hey, what do you think of this thing? What is your opinion on the way we should treat this in society or government or whatever? What is your personal experience that you can tell us a story that happened to you that illuminated this? And my ultimate feeling is that there are a certain very small percentage of people in Canada that go and put their comments on comment sections, right?
Yeah.
It's like if you look at the CBC comment section, it's the same 30 people on every story, right? And the point is you want like a wide range of people giving their honest opinion on this thing. And I think one of the challenges with comment sections across Canadian media and probably everywhere else in the world is that they've become dominated by a small group of very loud people that it makes it very difficult to cut through all the chaff and find people who have something new to add to the stories.
Do you know who these people are? Like, have you got a sense of who they are and their place in society that they need to do this online every day? And
I don't know. I mean, on the other hand, there are plenty of people who just read, oh, that's an interesting thing, and I'd like to give my opinion or criticism or feedback, and there's plenty of there. But I mean, I don't really know. But you do see the same bunch of names on a ton of stories.
Did you find that in the discourse that there is a disagreement not only on issues or subjects, but just a variance in the agreed set of facts?
Yeah, and that's where I think it is less useful than it is, right? The best conversations come when people agree on all the facts, right? Like.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way the best debates happen. That's the way. And it's very difficult to have a conversation where two sides are saying, no, I disagree with the premise of this very basic conversation. And so here's all the challenges with the premise of this conversation. We witnessed a car crash. We could both agree that, okay, that car hit the side of that car. What factors led to that car crash? And hey, did you see the driver, whether he was talking on the phone or not? But instead, what I think a lot of times happens is, you know, I'll say, hey, did you see that car crash? And you said, yeah, the brown car went into the side of the white car. And I'll say, no, Joseph, you idiot.
Yeah, you're
an
idiot.
The white car went into the side of the brown car.
Or just, you're an idiot. And
right.
And what are you doing looking at the cars?
Yeah. Yeah. The problem with this is you were looking at the cars in the first place. You should have been looking at the planes.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, happens a lot in comment sections, and it just makes me wonder how worthwhile they are. And because there is a worthwhile purpose. As I said, you want people to say, here's my experience, or here's my informed opinion, or here's this, or here's that. And you want to get these great conversations happening, because that's the whole point of journalism, is to give people something to talk about, to decide issues, and decide what we're going to do with the world that we have. It's this great potential. Comment sections, they should be full of life and agreement and disagreement and debate and discourse, but a lot of times they're just not.
Is that the same experience you've had with Twitter, though?
Well, Twitter's a different.
I mean, Twitter. Yeah. I mean, Twitter has its problems, but I mean, it's a little more probably. It's a lot more trouble to say get a hold of you on Twitter than it would be just to make a comment at the end of a post online.
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, one of the interesting things that also you find working in journalism and looking at the different mediums in which people can comment on, there is a different quality and tone to everything you get. So we already talked about what comment sections, the kind of discussions that happen in comment sections. Twitter, I find, quite often people will, like if they find a piece of journalism they like, they'll retweet it and add what is usually personal experience. They'll quote tweet and say, yeah, this happened to me, or hey, this reminds me of this other event, or further reading on this particular thing is this thing that I or someone else wrote. The other thing that Twitter is really good at is snark, and I kind of like the snark on Twitter. Good snark. And when it Twitter really challenges in terms of, like, coming up with those agreed set of facts. Twitter is really good at snarkily pointing out why someone might not agree with a particular fact that we're all supposed to agree with. But anyway, so Twitter's its own thing, and then Facebook comments, when people post something on their Facebook page and write that, that's also really, really good, because people really, really often have these kind of long, in-depth personal experiences that they want to add to some piece of journalism, and it's really, really cool. And then the emails, when someone, like, will put out a story and people will email us, usually that's the best stuff that comes in, right? You get an email with someone responding to some story, and you get kind of long essays from people that include both personal experience and personal expertise and their opinion on a thing. So each method of listener feedback has its own ups and downs, and they all have their own kind of tenor. And emails where it's one person who feels like they are privately in conversation with the journalists, there's so much richness in there. So I really like it when we get a chance, either on the coast or any CBC show, to take people's emails and read them on the radio, because they're often really, really thoughtful. People spend a lot of time to put their thoughts into writing, and it's often, to me, the best way of getting new perspectives and new opinions on the radio.
By the way, have you noticed in your career at the CBC thus far a decrease in the number of emails? Because, I mean, no one emails anymore, right?
Yeah, no, we get a lot of them. We get a whole lot of emails, and I'm not sure if there was a decrease. I've definitely noticed, even in my career at the CBC, a decrease in physical letters. We used to get a lot of those, and I received a few in my time. Postcards people send in. Every once in a while, someone will still fax in an opinion. Our fax number is still floating out there. But to me, email is still going strong. And a lot of that is because of, like, I guess it depends if you qualify web form as an email, because sometimes people just click on a thing and write a message.
Yeah.
That comes in.
In terms of, say, current affairs, Brexit, I think we're all talking about that.
Yep.
Last few days. Have you noticed just the level, in terms of the level of engagement that people have had on this issue, that the result, I think, reflects how people were talking about it during the campaign and after?
I'm not sure. I while I'm very interested in it and have, you know, my own thoughts and done a lot of reading, I'm not familiar with quite how engaged your average citizen of the UK was with it. I have really enjoyed, though, the kind of steady stream of people that the BBC has dug up, of people who voted leave and either admit that they didn't know what that meant or would like to take back or change their vote. And it's really interesting. And I'm from what I understand, it seemed to me like people in the UK were very engaged, but they didn't all agree on what they were actually voting on. And it makes me think of one of the challenges with referenda itself is what politicians think people are voting on.
Yeah.
Is not always what people think they're voting on. So I think it's probably a safe analysis that in the UK, a lot of people voted leave to either stick it to David Cameron because they don't like him, or stick it to the elites in society, or stick it to Brussels because they're fed up with diktats from those Belgians, and a whole lot of reasons, none of them particularly maybe related to the specifics,
the actual issue, yeah.
Whether or not the EU improves, being in the EU does this, and how difficult it would be to get out. And I think it's something that we should talk about referendums. And, you know, there are two Canadian referendums that we talk about that this might be an issue for. And, like, one of the things I thought of on the Brexit result was the HST referendum. So speaking of emails and comments and stuff, so during the HST referendum, I was at kind of on the coast. I was getting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails, and really got a sense of what people, although they agreed the HST referendum was about tax policy, decided to vote one way or the other because of their feelings about Gordon Campbell or the Liberals,
yeah,
or all of these other factors in society. And my, and again, this is very subjective, but my sense of the driving force behind people's desire to vote against the HST was they wanted to sanction Gordon Campbell for saying before the election that he wasn't going to bring in the HST. It wasn't at all about the actual policy of the HST,
mm-hmm,
the economics of it, this and that. It was about whether or not Gordon Campbell should have said that he wasn't going to bring it in, whether he lied. And that isn't wrong, right? Like, people can vote on whatever things they would like to vote on, right? Like, mm-hmm, no one says that you had to vote Liberal in the last election because you really like Liberal policies. It's perfectly valid in a democracy for someone to say, I voted for the Liberals because I like Justin Trudeau's hair, right?
Yeah.
Like, we don't have rules on what you're supposed to vote on, but it does, it should inform, and it can inform, the way we craft questions and whether or not referenda are the best things to have in a certain case. And, you know, maybe one thing we can talk about in BC is whether or not referenda on tax policy is a good idea, for example, because, you know, if there were some other remedy to say, okay, how should we as a society punish Gordon Campbell for saying before the election, let's not do HST and afterwards let's do it, then maybe that's better than saying, okay, let's hold up the whole policy for debate.
Mm. So in terms of the result of, with Brexit, do you think you people in the media have a role or responsibility, I should say, of say the way that the public has understood some of these issues?
Yeah, and I think that's it's an interesting point. So absolutely, and again, I wasn't in the UK, but I would imagine, based on my knowledge of how journalists work, that I would imagine that most UK journalists operated under the assumption that Brexit was a referendum about whether or not to leave the EU, right? And that and they told stories about the policy implications of what will happen if they do, the benefits and drawbacks of being in, all of that stuff. And it, and I would imagine that probably a vast minority of the conversation in mainstream media in the UK was about those feelings of being ruled by a distant elite,
mm-hmm,
or whether certain classes in society has as much say, or other issues. And I think journalists should take a real lesson: is that we can't treat government policy or things as something limited to government. It's about society, and it's about everyone. And not everyone agrees that that very specific high-end policy is what we're always talking about.
So when you look at the two votes we had here,
mm-hmm,
HST,
yep,
TransLink,
yep,
As a journalist in this part of the world, how did you view your role in terms of speaking to your audience about these issues and making the distinction between how people voted or what they thought they were voting for as opposed to the actual policy of taxation?
Right, and I think on the coast they did a very good job of trying to manage, and I think a lot of people had learned from the HST referendum that people vote on different things. And I think very quickly a lot of outlets, CBC and NW, and a lot really concluded very quickly, and it was really smart, that the TransLink referendum wasn't actually about
taxes.
taxes or TransLink funding. It was about CEO compensation, right? Mm-hmm. And the feeling out there was CEOs get paid this much and that much, and why would we pour more money into this system when, you know, you have a millionaire running the place? And I think a lot of...
Two millionaires at one point, right? Yeah.
Well, exactly. And that is a great example of how kind of governments forget that stuff, and it's and government agencies forget it. Because if they realized, they thought it was a distraction, right? They thought the CEO pay thing was a distraction to the conversation instead of being the actual conversation. So they thought by swapping out the CEO, they would kind of put an end to that conversation. But they didn't think it through, because you now have two paid people, and that's exactly what people were talking about. It wasn't a distraction to the real conversation of the referendum.
Yeah.
It was the heart of it. And I think a lot of people kind of got that in journalism. What I think we could do better next time is getting more voices from the people that feel that, right? And putting those up for scrutiny. And I think where people go wrong is when you journalists say, no, this is what the conversation's about. So you have this planning expert who says, here's all the money TransLink would do to accomplish all of these things. And you put, you know, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation on to say, oh, we already pay far too much in taxes and we should limit it. Instead of someone who really honestly represents the feeling that no one's talking about, which is, I don't like the idea that someone at a publicly owned transportation agency makes this much money. It makes me feel like we're just kind of paying taxes to prop up this person. And then you can put that up for scrutiny and talk about that and say, you know, have conversations about, you know, if we didn't pay this particular manager that much money, you know, the New York or Seattle Transportation Agency would be happy to have them. Mm-hmm. And how much will we pay to get good people? And do we actually believe that there is some kind of correlation between pay and the quality of people that we get in an agency? And I think that's where we kind of often go wrong, is we think, oh, that's not part of the conversation we're supposed to be having, so let's not have it. And then it kind of carries away. Or you actually have that conversation and it allows everyone to get it out in the open, come to their own conclusions on it, see if it makes sense or not, and then really have a far more informed point of view when they go and actually vote.
On the issue of affordability in Vancouver, because that's what we seem to be consumed with,
yeah,
in the media, everyone's talking about it. Do you think we're having the right conversation on that?
That's difficult. And, you know, earlier we talked about the agreed set of mm-hmm. facts. And one of the challenges with the conversation is that we have no facts. Right? We've got a lot of indications that our housing market is propped up by foreign, probably mostly Chinese mm-hmm. money. We don't have specific facts about it, right? Like, all of the actual facts we have about that are these weird kind of estimates.
Anecdotes.
Anecdotes, and there are weird studies that you know, involve mainland Chinese names on land titles. And, you know, we have a lot of Chinese people in this part mm-hmm. of town. And then, like, power usage and forget it. And I think, like, if we really want to have a conversation about it, we need to get some actual facts. One thing that to me doesn't really make sense and I think a lot of people spend a lot of time talking about it, and other journalists can disagree, but there's this other conversation going on about whether or not it's racist to point to offshore mm-hmm. Chinese money.
Yeah.
And I'm skeptical that that's a conversation that real people have. And I think that conversation is limited to a very small group of people who we already kind of give time to. Like, I'm not convinced that anyone out there, regardless of their ethnic heritage, thinks it is racist to say, or wonder, or consider, or ask whether it's offshore Chinese money. And I don't really think there's a big, huge push to say, don't say that it's offshore Chinese money because that's racist. I mean, a couple of people have used that word, but I really don't think it's a big significant issue that people are discussing.
So when we see it in the media, as media consumers, as citizens, as voters, should we tune out? I mean, should we take everything we hear with a grain of salt? Is it hysteria, perhaps?
No, I don't think it's hysteria. I mean, there are other facts that we can all agree on. One, that housing is extraordinarily expensive here, that it's disconnected from local incomes, that, you know, it's very hard to be young and not a renter in this city. I think there are other things that could be more, that we could talk about more, and that is interprovincial migration. Like, a lot of people come to Vancouver from other
provinces,
parts of Canada. And, like, look around. It is the most beautiful place in the world. So it's probably unfair to say, oh, the only reason that housing is this expensive is because of offshore Chinese money. Like, everyone would love to live in Vancouver, and I'm sure, you know, there's no way to me the price of housing is going to actually start going down, even if we clamp off Chinese investment. Like, people are already scrimping and putting up a bunch of money to buy houses here. It's not like people are being, you know, driven out across the country. People still decide to buy houses here, and for many people it's worth it because it's a beautiful city. It's close to the border. It's got the headquarters of a bunch of international companies in it, and it's great. So I think we're probably missing something in the conversation if we give people the impression that, oh, as soon as we choke off foreign investment,
we cool it off, it'll be fine.
We cool it off, and like a 22-year-old and his dog can buy a detached house somewhere, right? It's never, ever going to happen.
So when we see it discussed as it is ad infinitum on the news, in the newspapers, it's obviously an important discussion to have, but do you think it's being featured because that's what audiences want? And are you people as journalists only, say, feeding the beast, if you will, and giving the people what they want for because of eyeballs and clicks and,
sure,
and ratings, say?
Yeah, I used to think that it was too much when I was younger and kind of starting out in journalism and being an unmarried person. I really didn't think about real estate and house pricing as much as everything I experienced in the news and in a newsroom, and all of my colleagues insisted was really important story. But I think it is, like, it's something that infects Vancouverites and their minds and their dinner party conversations. To me, it's like you can't go anywhere without people talking about not even the cost of housing, but, like, I think one of the weird distinctions that Vancouverites fail to make often, and journalists don't help it, is the relationship between the cost of housing and property values, right? Which are basically two ways of saying the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So something about Vancouverites, we're constantly worried about our property values, right? We don't want the park next door to change because it might affect our property values. We don't want the tower down the street because it might affect our property values.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want this because it might affect our property values. But, oh, do something about the cost of housing, right? It's this, and I've been in conversations and at dinner parties and at coffee shops when people actually say those things, and I think that's unique to, I think that's part of the Vancouver psyche, and so It's my impression that when journalists talk so much about the cost of housing and property values, they're just taking part in the conversation that's already going on about there.
And so the media is just reflecting that then?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah, maybe. I think one of the things that probably the media does that people aren't talking about is these endless lists of where Vancouver places on things. Right? It's like, Vancouver's the most livable city, Vancouver's the least livable city, Vancouver's the most bike. Nobody cares. No one cares except for the tourism agency or polling company or toothpaste manufacturer that put out that thing, and the journalist who said, well, people love stories about Vancouver property and where we are, so let's put that out. And I don't think anyone cares.
Yeah, like if Chicago came out number two to Vancouver, I don't think you'd watch any of the Chicago newscasts and say, hey, we're number two. But if Vancouver came in number four, number eight, that's a story that's going to be on the news that night.
Totally. Right? And the flip side to that is no one gets one of those lists and says, oh, Chicago's the most livable city? Quick, let's start researching houses in Chicago and move there. It's nothing. It's meaningless. It's silly.
So it says something about us in this place here, right? Mm-hmm. More than anything. And I guess it's one of those endless conversations that we could have about what being, well, they've got books on what Canadian is. I mean, we could start a whole library on what Vancouver is.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It looks like you've got a whole bookshelf on what Canadian is.
Pretty much, yeah. Ooh. Yeah, I've read almost none of them, so... Do you worry, though, because you have such an appreciation of history, about how the city is changing and people realizing how it's changing and how quickly it's changing, say?
Yeah. It is interesting. The Grandview Woodlands debate ongoing. And I do think that's a big part of it, is people have always, they always want a place that they know and love remain somewhat similar.
Mm-hmm.
I live in the West End, and the West End has been, you know, the same kind of place for as long as I can remember it. Davie Street has had its ups and downs, but it's always, you know, the Village. And I can imagine, you know, the economist mind in me thinks, of course, like, there are still one-story buildings on Davie Street, right? Like, it's a stretch of one- and two-story low-rise commercial front and maybe one or two apartments out back along Davie Street. And the economist mind, not that I'm an economist, but I did a show on it, says, like, it's ridiculous. Right, we're having all these conversations about affordability and how it's tough to live here. There should be no low-rise or single-story buildings on Davie Street in the downtown core at all. Like, bulldoze them all, put up towers. Eventually, you get enough places that people can live there and pay rent and maybe get a mortgage and buy a condo or whatever. And then, of course, there's another side, and that is, well, no, I liked Davie Street the way it was 20 years ago, and that's the way it should stay now, and just a little coffee shop is much better than a big Walmart. And it doesn't make sense, right? It's except for on an emotional level, and people have that real emotional attachment to it. So I think in the sense of keeping those places the way we want, it's really understandable. And I think a lot of the conversations that happen around planning and construction and development really ignore that emotional attachment and connection that people have to the places, because the places make the culture of the city. And if there's one thing Vancouver could improve on, it's culture, right? Like heart and soul and the beating heart of it. And so when we have pockets of culture like they have on Commercial Drive and in Grammy Wood and those things, you obviously want to be able to foster them and protect them. And I think, again, when we agree about what kinds of conversations we're having, that should be a really important part of those development conversations, is let's acknowledge that the places have real impacts and connections to people. But let's acknowledge the economics as well. And instead of ignoring them and fighting over them, let's say, let's honestly weigh them. And let's find out a way to say, how much weight do you have because you've lived here 30 years versus the people who would like to live here and the people who say the number one issue in this city is affordability. And let's weigh those and treat them honestly.
Other than being an actor, did you want to be an economist?
No. You know what? I am terrible at mathematics. If I were better at math, not that there's a huge amount of math.
No.
But I'm just terrible. I'm terrible with numbers. I cannot figure them out. If I were better at numbers, I may have wanted to be an economist.
And it's just easier to do, say, 12 episodes of a show and pretend
exactly.
You're an economist.
And then if I want to be a historian, I can just do a show about history, right? It's great. So this is the fun. But if anyone's out there thinking about being a journalist, go for it, because you can pretend to be so many different other things.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to grow up to be a talk show host, and I guess
here you are.
Barely, but I mean, I sort of realized why I didn't want to do it, and you know what I mean.
What's that?
Be a talk show host or go into journalism, because it's just a tough slog.
Ah, that's true.
It's just easier to just ask people questions in this format.
Yeah, but it is what you are doing, right? The
beats collecting stamps.
There is no certification for being a journalist. You're doing it right now.
Well, you can get certified, though, if you're talking to people.
Oh, can you?
If you're talking to people in your basement alone.
Oh,
you know,
you're right.
Without a guest. I mean,
sure.
You are here, right?
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes, you are. I will attest that you are not presently certifiable.
Not at the moment.
Yeah.
Maybe the next hour.
Yeah.
Back to the 180 for just a second.
Mm-hmm.
You've been making these road trips,
yeah,
the whole show, and I find it fascinating because you did one. We went someplace in Alberta recently.
We went all over Alberta. Well,
yeah.
We went mid and central and southern Alberta.
Yeah, and then you did this one on Surrey a couple weeks ago, and I thought that was fascinating because, I mean, I've been to Surrey.
Mm-hmm.
I live close to it, but I've never really thought about it.
Yeah, and that's why we... that's why we did it. It's one of those places that you hear things about, but no one really spends a lot of time, unless you live in Surrey, to really get to know the place. Also, it just so happens that a few of us, or three of us, the three people on the 180, spent time or grew up in Surrey.
Mm.
So I grew up in South Surrey, a place that many people pretend is White Rock. So they can avoid saying they live in Surrey.
Yeah.
But even if they're too far away from White Rock to say South Surrey, they'll still really say, even if someone says, hey, where do you live? They'll never say Surrey. They'll say South Surrey.
Well, when you said South Surrey, I was about to say, oh, the nice part of Surrey, right?
Well, yeah. that's the point, is people really got to sneak that south in there. And one of the things that we discovered during our road trip is the border between regular Surrey and South Surrey seems to be creeping quite far north these days, and people up in, you know, Newton might say, I
wow.
live in South Surrey.
Yeah.
So it's a funny thing. But, yeah, Surrey's an interesting place. It's also got a lot going on in terms of urban development. So Surrey is big, huge, sprawling mass,
mm-hmm.
right? It's got... it's got a kind of suburban area in the very south, South Surrey, and then a little enclave, a little pocket called Crescent Beach, which is the upper crust part of
the swishy part, yeah.
Surrey. And then you've got this big band of farmland through the middle. So there's big agriculture. And then north of the farmland, you've got the huge urban sprawl. You've got the suburbs and gas stations and stuff for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. And then a few years ago, Surrey people realized that, hey, we built ourselves a city without a downtown. There's no central part of the city. And let's come up with a plan to craft a downtown core in Surrey. And they're actually doing it right now, or they're trying to do it. They're building great big skyscrapers. They've got a new city hall and a new library and this huge plaza, and they've got an SFU campus out there connected to a mall, and they're trying to create from scratch a downtown. And it's interesting. And no one's quite sure how it'll work, if it'll work, and how long it'll take to work. Because still, really weird part of driving around this kind of downtown that they're trying to make is their blocks, right? And this is a very simple thing. The blocks in Surrey, the block size, are just enormous.
Yeah,
right?
Like, a two-block walk is, what, a kilometer here?
Yeah, right? Like, if you want to walk down the block,
yeah,
it takes you 20 minutes. And then the block actually doesn't butt up against anything. So every block is, right beside you is like a quarter mile of parking lot, and then the thing that is on that block.
Yeah.
Right? So there's nowhere you're just walking along, and there's like, you know, stores and shops and coffee shops and people on the patio. I mean, there are that kind of thing kind of fabricated in little pockets around the city in those kind of little mall things that they're trying,
yeah,
to create. But the downtown core doesn't have that strip like Robson or a Granville or anything where there's like sidewalk, store, patio, coffee, people smiling, laughing, having a good time. And it's going to be a huge challenge to try and make that.
Yeah. What have you got any like plans over the summer in terms of? By the way, is it 180 on in the summertime or?
Yeah, we go right through. We're I think
yeah,
so.
Yeah, you're not one of these national shows,
no,
that go off for a couple months. Have you got plans in terms of taking the show elsewhere?
Not yet, but we might. When it looked like we might have an LNG industry, we were thinking about heading up north of BC to do that, but that seems to be a tough go as well.
So we talked about journalism and the media, and one of the conversations that we've had over the years on Twitter, you and I, has been on Murphy Brown, the television,
yeah,
show. It's a show that you liked growing up, right?
Yeah.
As did I. I enjoyed that show a great deal.
Yeah, loved it. Wonderful show.
And it's one of those underrated shows. I mean, it was at the time, it was critically acclaimed. She won all those Emmy Awards,
yeah,
Candace Bergen did. But it's just, it hasn't had the shelf life that, say, other shows of that era, like, well Seinfeld is sort of an anomaly.
Yeah.
But, you know, other shows of the 90s that yeah, seemed to be syndicated.
Totally. It is really weird because it was such a good show. And it made a lot of waves at its time, right? Like, remember the whole thing with Dan Quayle
yeah,
and sending the stuff to... It was a weird thing. But it was really influential, and now it's nowhere on the dial. You can surf around. You can find lots of great old sitcoms. You can find
mm-hmm.
MASH, and you can find the WKRP in Cincinnati on TBS like
yeah.
every day. It's impossible to find Murphy Brown, and
yeah.
I don't quite know why it is, but I loved it. I was, now to be honest, I was quite young when Murphy Brown. I was probably not Murphy Brown's target audience.
Yeah, no.
I was a little on the younger side. But I do wish that it was still out there and people, because sometimes I'll make a Murphy Brown reference at work and no one will know what the heck I'm talking about. So I do wish it was out there more.
And was it a show, because it was about journalism, that perhaps made you consider a career in that field?
At the time, like, I never make a direct link, I don't think, between Murphy Brown and my decision to go into journalism. I basically went into journalism after I tried for a long time and failed to become a professional actor. So going into journalism, my thought was, what is really important to me and what do I love in the world? And it was really the amount of time and passion and excitement that to me came from listening to CBC Radio. So I went into journalism pretty much with the specific plan to end up at CBC Radio. And I had kind of forgotten how much I enjoyed Murphy Brown at the time. But watching it now is a lot of fun because I can remember watching it when I was a kid and thinking, wow, this is in the big city and they're doing big, important things. And now I watch and say, yeah, I work in that business.
Yeah.
And you know, some of the trials and tribulations of broadcast news. So it's a lot of fun. I still like watching it. It's a cozy experience.
Shows like WKRP, News Radio, The Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yep.
Did I mention News Radio? Do they, Murphy Brown, do they sort of, their portrayal of what it's like to work in a newsroom, is there an accuracy there?
Yeah, so, I mean...
Because the funny thing is that people, I've talked to cops over the years.
Yeah.
And, you know, you would say, well, are you like Columbo? I mean, is your work like Columbo? Is it like NYPD Blue or Law & Order?
Right.
And they say, one person said to me that the best portrayal of police was Barney Miller.
Mm.
And you wouldn't think that because it was a sitcom.
Right.
But so I'm wondering, in your field, is
yeah.
that...
Yeah. It's difficult, because whenever there's journalism going on in movies and TV, they have so much time. And, well, it's either... When you see a newsroom in either Murphy Brown or WK or Mary Tyler Moore, it's either panic mode 24/7 and papers flying through the air, or it's people have weeks to put together a story. And it's ridiculous. Like, Murphy Brown would sit in her office and say, oh, like, next week I'm doing a feature on John Sununu or something.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff never happens, right? It's like journalism is of the day. People are working that day to get something together that day. But it's also some, like on election night at any newsroom in the country is probably closest to what people think based on movies and TV is happening in newsrooms. So election nights, there is literally papers being thrown and flying. People are running things in and out of the radio and TV studios, and people are sweating and running and screaming and swearing. And if you ever wanted to visit a newsroom, do it on election night because that's when all of the excitement happens. To me, I think the best fictional representation of a newsroom is Superman 1.
Huh.
The original, like, 1979?
Like Christopher Reeve?
Reeve 1, where the newsroom is a relatively calm place. Some people are a little more excited than others. And people have these rational discussions about what the story is going to be that day. And, you know, one person doesn't... consistently misspells words, and that takes up a lot of people's attention and time. I think Superman 1 was probably the most accurate.
I'll have to watch it this summer, then. I'll add it to the list of things that I need to watch. But, I mean, I must say, in terms of interviewing, I mean, just the process of interviewing, I always thought I had some insight into that early on from having watched Murphy Brown.
Mm. Yeah.
And a lot of fictional interviewers I've learned from over the years, like Ali G or Borat or Jiminy Glick even.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny how you pick up on... Well, I guess that's why they created those characters, was to poke fun at the process of asking people questions.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah, and like Jiminy Glick is a great example of what not to do. It's fantastic. Like, every question he asked is prefaced by a complete untruth, or, you know, people say you are X and Y, what do you have to say about that? Which is the silliest. So, like, to me, Jiminy Glick is a great resource to learn what not to do, and it's pretty fantastic. But now I can't... It's been a while since I've seen a Murphy Brown where she's actually grilling someone. But my recollection is...
It was more of the process of, say, well, did we book Aretha Franklin, or did we book Sununu?
Yeah.
The plane hasn't arrived, or the sitting, making sure everything's to time, like Jim Dial getting his little thing at the end of the show, you know, that little synopsis of what we just saw, getting that together. I mean,
those
sorts of things I thought that show was good at.
Yeah, and there are a lot of weird kind of mechanics of newsroom operation that show up in Murphy Brown and are really great, because that occupies a lot, especially in broadcast, occupies a lot of time and effort and energy. It's just making sure all those little bits and pieces work right in order to let the actual real question asking and journalism take place.
So I remember when I first started watching the show with regularity, like as it was coming out every Monday night, this is how I geeked out. You would see on the assignment board.
Yep.
You would see that week or the next week on there.
Yes.
And you would see certain current events things like Clinton, whatever,
mm-hmm.
on the board.
Yeah.
And I guess if you go back, then you can see stuff from the late 80s, the early 90s.
Hmm.
But I remember seeing that as it was happening and saying, hey, this show is really current.
Yeah. And we do have the big white boards. Those boards that are in every newsroom movie, we've got those boards. We spend a lot of time on those boards.
And then she had all the magazine covers on her office wall and the Emmy.
Yes.
Was sitting there.
Yeah. Yes, and her new secretary.
Every week, yeah.
Every week. and then there was that excellent crossover episode where Kramer became
that's
Murphy
right.
Brown's...
He was an actor.
Secretary.
Yeah, that's right.
That was good times.
And everybody showed up on that show, like real journalists, and that gave it the sort of, that it was, like she was a real person in the field. You know, you'd have Katie, I don't know if Katie Kirk ever did the show, but you had people like Connie Chung and the people of that era show up.
One thing that, for some reason, and I guess it was because I was a bit young when I was watching it, I never quite appreciated how perfect the name Jim Dial was. And, like, it's one of those things in script writing, probably, that is kind of so obvious, but also so subtle and great. Like, when they were creating that character, they had to think, okay, how do we perfectly capture the name of the most bland newscaster that you could just flip the channel and find anywhere in the entire country, no matter where you put the dial? Jim Dial. And it was such a perfect name to me. I always really, really love and appreciate that name.
Yeah, and then Frank Fontana was the person on the field, and that just sounded like an action name.
Yes,
right?
Frank Fontana, and they ripped it off in Anchorman. Because what's his name's character? The pretty boy there. Oh, I can't remember. But one of the members of the action news team on Anchorman was Frank Fontana.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. That's right.
Changed one letter.
Yeah.
But that's how good a name it was.
And it made me, you know, about 6 months ago, I ended up looking up, you know, how they created these characters and so the Jim Dial character was an amalgam of two anchors in New York, one at CBS, Jim Jensen, and a guy at ABC who I can't remember now, Bill Buetel.
Okay.
And so at the end of every broadcast, Bill Buetel would do this rant at the end, or not a rant, but, you know, this breathless 15-second thing of what we just saw.
Right.
And Jim Jensen, on the other hand, was more of the Jim Dial, you know, hello, you know, that sort of the old style anchor that we don't see anymore nowadays. And there's some great clips, by the way, of Jim Jensen. He was a terribly troubled person. He was an older fellow. He was probably in his 60s, and had silver hair, but he had some problems with drugs and alcohol, and sometimes you can see these things on the air. His script would be, he would say, out of order because of the new computer system, but it wasn't.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I mean, that's based on my impression of journalism from movies and television. I was expecting, quite frankly, far more people who had significant alcohol problems, because there's always that scene in the movie where the guy opens the desk of his drawer and he's got a 40 or something in there. He's trying to get that column in, and he's writing the thing and drinking the scotch. Far less substance abuse in a real newsroom. But, as you mentioned, it is an issue among some people.
Yeah. I'm just going to bring up something I forgot now. It'll come to me eventually, probably after this interview's finished and it's too late. But when you like the newsroom, for example, the Aaron Sorkin show. I mean, did you watch that?
I didn't. I saw the first little bit, and
people hate watch that, right?
I think they did. And again, I shouldn't really talk too much about it because I didn't really watch it. But my impression of
why let that stop it? You know, we're
Why let that stop it? My impression of the bits that I saw was that, and I could be totally wrong, because again, I don't know what I'm talking about. I will admit right now, I don't know what I'm talking about. But it did seem that the purpose of the show was to say, here's what a non-news person thinks is wrong with news, and that thing that they think is wrong with news is, and again, I could be totally wrong here, is it's not left-wing enough. Is that that seemed to be the purpose of it?
Yeah, that well, yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, having seen everything, yeah, no, I think you're right. That's you haven't seen the show, but you've obviously read a lot of think pieces on it, right?
I haven't. I just watched the thing, and it just seemed like
it was not as activist as it could be,
right? And so it's not exactly not as activist, but I think this is like not as explicitly one perspective as some people would like it to be.
Yeah. Are you paying attention to the race in the United States for president?
How can you not?
Yeah.
I mean, well, there's two. How can you not because it's so entertaining? And also, how can you not because it's just everywhere? And it is interesting. I'm interested in what will happen. I'm interested in the implications of what will happen. What do you think?
The most interesting thing that I've seen when people cover it in this town is that they're always looking for an angle to Vancouver because that's the only way that it can get on the 6 o'clock news.
Right.
The other thing that I found interesting early in the campaign when Trump was starting his campaign, how some of the anchors in this town, and I could name them, but why bother? Were openly hostile towards Trump, where they wouldn't think to do that to Mitt Romney,
right.
Mike Huckabee, or even any of the other candidates. And so now I wonder whether in their news reporting, mind you, it's just a Vancouver newscast. It's not like the NBC Nightly News or the CBS Evening News, whether they will continue to have the sort of actual physical disdain on the air that towards Trump if he is when he does get the nomination or if he gets elected, say.
Yeah, it's going to be weird. And I think most journalists, most mainstream journalists, although I hate that term, haven't hid their surprise that Trump has gotten as far as he has. Their disdain for some of the kind of racist things that he said, his habit of talking about policies where he doesn't seem to know what he's talking about. There are a lot of things that you can say about Trump that are accurate and make a reasonable person come to the conclusion that he should not be president. And I think the challenge for journalists there is to decide what's the journalism part. And so, to give you a broad distinction or listeners, like it's journalistically sound to say, it's probably journalistically sound to say Donald Trump has proposed racist policies. You could have a debate in a newsroom about whether that's an accurate statement, but you could probably get away with it and maintain your journalistic integrity. And I think the distinction about what is probably not safe to say is, and that's why Donald Trump shouldn't be president, right? And I think the goal of journalists in this sense is to say, you know, Donald Trump, who has proposed racist policies, what are the implications for Canada and that? And so, you know, say, okay, we are comfortable with the fact that this policy or set of policies are informed by this thing. What do you, the public out there, think about that? And then you can say, actually, his worldview isn't the most important thing to me. What I like about him is his can-do attitude or whatever. But as long as we agree that journalists are doing what journalists are supposed to do, which is to collect and distribute facts and facilitate conversations, then I think everyone's okay. And where I think it's dangerous is when it ends up at the tone that, like, this is not a person who should become president.
Do you think that he's changed journalism? I mean, this whole Trump phenomenon, I mean, we're going into a provincial election here.
Yeah.
I mean, I could easily see a candidate sort of act like Trump.
Yeah.
And get away with it because he's saying, well, you know, you had a guy in the States who's running the same sort of and treating the media as he did. And so in that regard, I mean, you know, there was one incident with Trump during the primary season where he refused to go on Fox News because he was upset at them that week. And he eventually lost that primary, that specific primary. But had he won, I think that would have changed the game. And even an outlet like Fox News would have been just sort of, you know, discounted. But, I mean, what I think it showed in that incident was that that an outlet like Fox, or media outlet altogether, still was relevant.
Right.
But it could have easily not, you know.
Yep. And I think there are lessons like that for journalists. And I don't think he's made the media in the United States irrelevant. I think he's pointed out a lot of flaws in the media in the United States that probably exist in Canada. To me, one of the silliest things that happened with the media relationship between Donald Trump was Huffington Post's early decision to categorize everything
put him as entertainment.
One, because it's not journalism to do that. To say someone should not be taken seriously is not journalistically sound. The other thing is, of course you should take Donald Trump seriously. The man has policies that are racist. Like, that's a guy that you should take as seriously as possible.
Or take him seriously because he's doing so well.
Yeah.
A lot of the so-called legitimate candidates are being, taken out of the field because he's doing so well.
Sure. And then part of the, like, in the bigger picture, we're trying to figure out how people feel in society. And like the Brexit conversation we had, Trump's success, or Trump, obviously speaks to a lot of people who want that kind of voice in society or are looking for some alternative to what's offered them and find that it's really appealing and really get jazzed up about it. And for in the early days, for media to just say, forget this stooge, you're also saying to all those people, forget you, and we don't care about your position.
You don't have a place.
Or you don't have a place at all. And, like, what journalists should really take seriously is that sentiment, the feeling of not being represented in society and those people. And when you say, like, this guy, you know, shouldn't be president, or this guy doesn't count, or this guy doesn't matter, or all of this stuff, then you're saying to those people, you know what, you can shut up and go away, and that just makes everything worse. And the Trumps of the world come out of that reaction. And if those people were included about conversations, and I know it's a tricky question because the response to that, well, is, okay, you want to include racist bigots in conversations? But the answer is no, is that stuff is a reaction to their not having a voice, right? Like, the overt, angry, bitter jerkiness is a reaction to not feeling included. in the media conversations that we have. So, like, I genuinely believe that the racism and vileness and bitterness and xenophobia that comes out of certain segments is a response to the way we already treat that group of people, which is not having a place at the table.
Marginalizing them and yeah. looking down upon them.
Yeah, and, you know, and not that we, like, the idea should be, is share their perspectives, and if most people agree that those are perspectives that we can look down yeah. on, then at least we included them, yeah. right?
It's been the time has just whizzed by mm-hmm. as it always does, and I again thank you for coming and doing this, and I appreciate the conversation as usual, and it's nice seeing you again.
Good to see you, Joseph. Thank you very much.
CBC.ca/the180 is the website for the show. The 180 airs on Sundays at 11 a.m. One of its producers, Matthew Lazenreiter, joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.